particular, so, and I'm very nervous. I just want to get that out there. So if I don't vomit within the next 50 minutes, we're doing really good. Okay, guys. My sobriety date is April 30th, 2009. So I will. Thank you. Yeah. Such a miracle, and I really cannot believe the woman that I am today. And, you know, when I say I can't believe it, I really can't believe it. When I take a step back and look at my life and how blessed I am and the woman that I've become, I know that I did not do that on my own accord. And so I know that it was a power greater than myself that has given me this beautiful life of abundance, like Michael said. Thank you. I just want to take a moment right now to thank the family members and loved ones for coming out to support the men and women who are in treatment here at Benchmark. I come from a long line of addicts and alcoholics, and my parents did not come to my family program. And my parents did not come to my sister's family program. You know, I asked them, I begged them, they wouldn't show up because I think because of their own shame. But as many of you know by now, that this disease of addiction, it affects the entire family, and the entire family needs to heal. So I just want to thank you so much for being brave enough to show up and to support your loved ones and also to take care of yourselves. You know, I have recovered from a hopeless state of mind and body. I have been rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence, just like the big book says, and I have a life that I never dreamed I could have. It has nothing to do with the external. It's about my internal condition. Today I have peace. I have serenity. I live most of the time without fear. I love who I am today. I can look myself in the eye in the mirror and be okay with who I am today. And that's just priceless. And that's what keeps me coming back again and again. That's what keeps me, you know, engaged in the program and doing this, because that is something that I never experienced before I got sober. I'm going to tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I don't really want to dwell too much on what it was like because, you know, that's in my past, but I want you all to know that I qualify to be here. You know, the science is getting closer and closer to proving that this disease can be genetic or hereditary. And I do believe that I was born with a spiritual malady. I believe that from a very, very early age, as far back as my earliest childhood memory, I have felt restless, irritable, and discontent. And that's what I use to describe the spiritual malady. Okay. And I started trying to change the way I feel from a very early age. There are two things that can kind of help jumpstart a person into addiction, and that is, genetic predisposition and also environmental factors. And so what you're about to hear, you'll understand maybe a little bit why I ended up the way I ended up. And, I started trying to change the way I feel by overachieving in school. That was my first way to numb out. So I wanted to win all the contest tests. I wanted to make perfect grades. I needed validation and recognition from my parents, my teachers, my peers. I needed them to validate me, to make me feel better. And so I really overachieved in school. I did a very good job at that, but it was never enough. I still always felt very different, very uncomfortable in my own skin. This is all in hindsight. I didn't consciously sit around in kindergarten and think, wow, I feel so different. I'm not the same as you. But I can look back now on that, and I can see it very clearly. And I mentioned changing the way I feel, and that's really what I'm addicted to, you know, when I'm in my disease, is changing the way I feel. And I'll do that with many different things, not just drugs and alcohol. I'll do that with men, with money, with clothes, cars, food, alcohol, uppers, downers, caffeine, nicotine, love. You know, I'll use anything I can to get out of right here, right now. Whatever gets me out of the pain of being me. And that's what it was like for me. And so, I just have this funny feeling that some of the women in this room might be able to relate to what I'm about to say, maybe not, but a big part of my story is that there was always a guy. And how bad or good I was doing on my drug use depends on what was going on in my relationship. Can anyone relate? You don't have to raise your hand. Just think. Okay, all right, I had a feeling. My childhood was pretty rough, but, you know, I'll tell you about that, but I just want to say that I don't use that as a reason why I use, it just happens to be part of my story, so I'm going to share it with you. I told you before, my parents were drug addicts. They smoked weed every single day. Weed was always around me. I knew at a very young age that it was a secret and that I wasn't supposed to tell anyone that my mom and dad were potheads. I do remember them acting really funny sometimes too, so I think they were using some other substances. I never saw them doing that, but I really highly suspect that they did. When I was 13, my house got raided by the task force. I got woken up with a flashlight in my face, and they took my dad off to jail. And that happened one other time in my childhood. My mom's best friend was this really wild stripper prostitute lady, and we hung out at her house all the time, and we were exposed to things as children, my sister and I, that probably children should not be exposed to. And I share that for two reasons. One, because it's part of my story, but also because there are a lot of us in this room who have experienced trauma in our lives. And we're told a lot in the rooms that, and in this program, that, you know, victims don't recover and you need to get out of self-pity. But I think it's also very important to acknowledge to some of us that that should not have happened to you, you know. And I'm here to tell you that if you've been victimized and you've experienced trauma in your life, that should not have happened to you. You know, it's messed up and it's not okay. But there is something that we can do with it today. And the question I have to ask myself is, how am I using it to help the next girl? What am I doing with it to help the next girl? Because there is someone else out there who's experienced these things that can benefit from my message. And that's why I share it. Okay. The overachieving went on and on. I think the first time I drank, I was 15 years old, or maybe a little younger, 14, 15. It was screwdrivers, it was orange juice and vodka. And we were over at my friend Janet Hunter's house, and a guy showed up with a big bottle of OJ and a big bottle of vodka. And I said, oh, I know what I'm doing. And I drank about 8 of those screwdrivers, and I drank them all sitting down. And I didn't think, yeah, that's what happened next. I stood up, and it hit me, and I was totally drunk. And by the end of the night, I had, you know, passed out in a puddle of my own vomit. I snorted Tylenol 3. I puked out of the door of a moving van going down the highway. It didn't happen how I planned for it to happen. But when I woke up the next morning and showered the vomit off of myself, what I remembered was not all of that embarrassing stuff. What I remembered is the freedom that the drink gave me. It made me feel important. It made me feel funny. It made me feel a part of. It made me feel pretty. It made me feel confident. It gave me everything that I felt I was missing. And so all I knew is that I needed to do that again. And so I did. And I was a big nerd in school. No boys talked to me. No girls wanted to be my friend. And that went on until I switched schools in high school and I decided I wasn't going to be that girl anymore. So I found a group of kids that were the misfits or the outcasts, and they were doing a lot of experimenting with different things, so I wanted to fit in, and so I did what they were doing. And I really did start using drugs because of that reason. I didn't necessarily like acid. I didn't necessarily like mushrooms. But I was cool because I could still pot for my parents, and so those people wanted to hang out with me. And so I found a group of friends. And, you know, in school, that means everything to you. That's the most important thing, is to feel like you're a part of and to feel like someone likes you. And so I was accepted by this group, and that's kind of how I got introduced to substances and took it to the next level. You know, I tried lots of different substances. You know, I had a long run with cocaine. And the funny thing about cocaine is that I hate speed. I absolutely hate speed. I would hold my hand on my chest and would say, I think I'm having a heart attack. I think I'm having a heart attack. Give me another line, you know? I did that for about a year and a half. It went on that way. And again, looking back, that's probably not normal, you know? And so I used like an addict, you know, from day one. And so I think that things Things really took a turn in my life when I found Xanax. Do we have any bar babies in the room? All right, we have a few. Cool. So you know that when you mix alcohol and Xanax, it is an instant blackout. You do not remember anything. And so I spent from about the age 18 to 30 in a total blackout. So I can tell you bits and pieces of what was happening in my life, maybe some of the highlights, but there's a lot that's just gone. And I actually still have some permanent memory damage to this day as a result of all that. So I found Xanax when I was about 18 years old, and it did everything that I described to you from that first drink. And I felt pretty and smart and funny and confident. I would clean my house for hours. You know, I'd file everything meticulously at work, but the problem is that I wouldn't remember where I put anything the next day. You know? And, I did that a lot. One time I woke up and I had two closets in my bedroom and I had switched everything. I switched the closets, the contents of the closet. I have no idea why I did that, but I found it the next day. It got to where I would call my own cell phone at night before I went to bed, and I would leave myself a voicemail, and I would say, "Okay, Sandy, you." Here's where you went to dinner. Here's who you were with. Yes, you showered. Your car is parked at so and so's house. And then I'd wake up the next morning and check my voicemail, and I'd hear, "Hey, Sandy." Have no clue what I did, what happened. It's pretty scary, you know, but that was my reality. I did things that ladies don't do that aren't appropriate to talk about from the podium, but I want the women in recovery in this room to hear that from me, because this speaker night is about hope, and then we don't have to live that way anymore, you know. It got to where I wasn't really showering on a regular basis. I wasn't eating. If you can imagine, I was about 25 pounds thinner than I am now. It was pretty gross, pretty scary. I couldn't look myself in the eye in the mirror. I hated who I had become. And, the way I paid my electric bill was that I'd come home and the electricity would be turned off. And I'd say, "Oh, okay, time to pay the electric bill," you know. And that's how I lived. And, there were men, boyfriends all along the way, and kind of whatever substance I was using was whatever substance he was using, and that relationship would fail, and then so here's what's happening, right? So I've got this spiritual malady, okay? So imagine, you know, there's a circle, and at 12 o'clock, there's a ticker, and it says spiritual malady, and I feel restless, irritable, and discontent. So that makes me have to change the way I feel, right? So I have this mental obsession that says you need to change the way you feel. And so I'm doing that, and I'm doing that successfully, because whenever I swallow that pill, about 15 minutes later, it kicks in, and I feel good, okay? And then I get the boyfriend, and he loves me, and that makes me feel good. And then I get the new car, and I'm driving down the road, and I like my new car, and I've got the job, and I'm going shopping, and all of these things do change the way I feel. All of these external things are working. Right? And so the problem, though, guys, is that those things are fleeting, and they don't fill the God-sized hole. They don't really fill the void. But what happens, because they do work for a little while, whenever they stop working, what my thought is, well, I just need to go get more pills. I just need to find a better boyfriend. I just need to get a better job. I just need to get another new car. I need to go shopping some more, right? Who can relate? Yes? I mean, that's what we do. And we repeat that cycle over and over and over. And eventually, we have to come to a pretty harsh reality that this isn't working. And that's a very scary place to be. Very scary place to be. No one wants to surrender. No one wants to wave the white flag. For me to think about never doing drugs again was terrifying. You know, I didn't want to live that way, but I didn't know how not to live that way. I could not imagine, you know. So there was a man in my life. His name is Elias. He is an angel, and he was a normie. He did not have any problems like me, and he gave me an ultimatum. And the first time I got help was I was 27 years old, and I was in and out of the rooms from 27 to 30. So I want you to know that if you're a repeat offender, if you've, you know, tried this before and weren't able to stay sober, that's okay. You know, well, that's part of the story for a lot of us. And it took me 3 years to, you know, be done for good and for all, God willing, you know. I went to an outpatient program, started AA. I wanted this. I wanted to be sober. I remember wanting to be sober. And I lasted about 5 months, and I went back out. And it's because I did not have a psychic change as a result of working the steps. Plain and simple. IOP can't keep you sober. AA can't keep you sober. Sponsors can't keep you sober. I needed a connection with a higher power, and I didn't have it. And so I went back out for a while, and then I tried it again. And again, this time I got a sponsor who was very Christian, and she had me work the steps from a Christian angle. And she had me get saved in front of her church for my third step. And I didn't know any better, so I did it. And I kind of faked it, like, yeah, this is, yeah, I felt something, but I really didn't. And that's my part in that, you know. I wasn't honest about it, and it didn't do anything for me. I didn't have a psychic change. I didn't have a spiritual awakening. So needless to say, I went back out after 7 months that time. And let me rewind for a minute. Whenever I was 21 years old, I found out that my dad was not my biological father. And I thought my whole life that he was. So that experience was obviously very traumatic for me. And it just kind of catapulted me a little bit further. I thought, well, if you had my life, if you've been through what I've been through, then you would drink too. You would get high too, you know. I know today that I was suffering from a disease, the disease of addiction, and it had nothing to do with external circumstances. It was my internal condition, my spiritual malady, that was causing the mental obsession that said you need to change the way you feel. And then once I consumed a substance, I set off the phenomenon of craving in my body, which said you need more, you need more, you need more. That's what I would do over and over and over again. Three-part disease. So back to 27. I relapsed a couple times. I don't even consider it a relapse, really, because I really never had any real recovery. So when I was 30 years old, I was cheating on Elias and with my 21-year-old trainer from the gym. And he was supplying me with Xanax and pot. And I thought it was really cool, though, that I had this 21-year-old guy. I was proud of that, if you can imagine, okay? And so he called me out, and he said, you know, are you going to admit to what you're doing? And he was talking about the drugs. You know, he knew everything. And I have this moment of grace, and that's the only way I can describe it, just this moment of grace where I actually could see the pain I was causing him. Because I think a lot of us can relate to what I'm about to say. I felt like, this is my life. Why don't you all just leave me alone and let me do what I want to do? And I couldn't see that I was hurting anyone else. And I had this moment of clarity and where I saw his spirit. And I said, okay, I'll get help. Well, I had just quit my job, and I did not choose to exercise the COBRA insurance, and so I knew there was no way I was going to treatment because I didn't have insurance. And so I told him I'd go, but I knew that I wouldn't ever end up there. Well, he's pretty smart. He overnighted a check, and about 2 weeks later, I was on a plane on my way to a treatment center. And that was April 30th, 2009, and I haven't had to drink or use since then. And I'll tell you what else, the obsession has been removed from me since I was about 5 months sober. And I'll tell you how that happened. And it was a result of working the 12 steps. And, you know, I was in treatment. I was in detox. Benzodiazepines are very difficult to come off of. And I was extremely depressed. I cried all the time. I said, I don't belong here with these people. These people are not like, I'm not like them. These people are crazy. Get me out of here. I don't belong here. But no one would come get me. I burned all of my bridges. I was out of options. What a great place for me to be. The first person to carry the message to me was my counselor in treatment. Her name is Maureen Hagen. Some of you may know her. She's another angel that was in my life. She sat across from me and told me her story. And she was well-groomed. You could tell she showered. She had light in her eyes. She had a job. She had letters behind her name. She had a car, you know. And it gave me, you know, my first little glimmer of hope that I can do this too. And so I started to pay attention in the groups. I started to open up with my counselor. I started to, you know, show up for my recovery, in other words. And I remember when I got out of that treatment center being terrified, you know, because I was safe and protected there. And now I had to go out into the real world and actually apply the tools and the skills that I had been given, you know. And I got a sponsor, and she took me through the steps. This was not a special, magical, perfect sponsor. It was a woman who had been through the work who was willing to take me through the work. And so my point is, we don't have to look for the perfect, you know, sponsor. You get someone and you get going on the steps. And I did step one, and after step one, I did step two. And after step two, I did step three. And then I kept going. And when I got to step 12, I had a psychic change as a result of working the steps. And I would look at the steps on the wall, and I would think, how is that going to fix me? I didn't even have to believe that it was going to work. I just had to be willing to try and to make the effort. I didn't even do it with enthusiasm. I just did it, you know, like, okay, fine. You know, I don't have any other option. I'll try it. And something happened. Something happened to me. And I'm so overwhelmed with gratitude in this moment to have come from that place, being that woman. You know, I didn't tell you this part. I would have stolen anything I could get from you. I would have slept with your boyfriend. I would have lied right to your face. I would have manipulated you, used you, and pretended to be your friend. And looked right in the eye when I was doing it, I was so disconnected from the sunlight of the spirit that I was totally numb to the fact that I was hurting people. I did not care. I couldn't feel it. And today, you know, my employer introduced me. I couldn't even show up for work on time. I would steal from my boss. You know? I have a relationship with my mother. She loves me, and I love her, and I show up for her. I have friends that love me, that show up for me, friends that value me as a friend. I went back to school. I have letters behind my name now. you know, I got sober in a little town called Kerrville, Texas. And in Kerrville, they don't mess around. There is no watered-down solution. Everything in the meetings is straight from the big book. And there are 65 meetings a week just for AA in that town, and not to mention the other fellowships. I'm so grateful for that experience. I stayed there for 3 years. Most people come in and go out. It's kind of a revolving door. But I like to think that I was very sick because I stayed in that town for 3 years. But I found a sense of purpose there. You know, I was able to sponsor women. I was able to give back what had been given to me. And I didn't want to leave. It was a very beautiful, magical, transformative experience for me. I remember the first the first time I realized that I had a connection with my higher power. And don't get too excited. This is not a burning bush experience. No. I was driving down the road, and I had a speeding ticket. And so I called the courthouse to take care of it. And when I hung up the phone, I realized that Sandy Hollier would have never done that. Never done that. And I thought, oh, my God, I just did something responsible. And then I just, thank you, God, thank you, God, thank you, God. And I can't tell you how many millions of times I have said that since then, in just the 5 years I've been sober, because so many miracles have happened in my life. I've sponsored hundreds of women. I've spoken at other treatment centers and meetings. I've lost a lot of people to this disease, too. And it does not have to be that way. There is a solution, and it works. And that is why we need each and every one of you on the front lines, down in the trenches, fighting the good fight against this disease. Alcoholics, addicts, and Al-Anons. Because we're all suffering, and there is hope, and there is a way out. And there are a lot of people in the program, but unfortunately there aren't a lot of people that are willing to really get down in the trenches and in fight. And we need each and every one of you doing that with us. I worked at the same treatment center that I was a client at. They hired me there. That was cool. The clients hated me. I was that tech. If you're a client here right now, you know what I'm talking about. I was that person. I'll say this too, and it's so weird getting up at the podium and being vulnerable to a room full of strangers, but at the same time, I definitely feel a connection with all of you. Like, you really are my brothers and sisters. And so there's a real sense of comfort in being up here and being open with you. And, I'll say that relationships have continued to be difficult for me. Relationships of the romantic nature, that is, ladies. And I've had a couple of failed relationships. I moved to Austin almost 2 years ago, and I got my heart broken really bad by a guy. And I knew that I knew what I had to do. I wanted to curl up in fetal position and go back to what's comfortable, meaning not showering, not eating, not going to work. I wanted to just give up and retreat into myself. But I knew what I had to do, and I picked up the phone and I called my sponsees. Because what does it say in working with others? It says, nothing so much assures immunity against drinking as intensive work with another alcoholic. So I picked up the phone and I called my sponsees. Hey, what are you doing? What's going on in your life? Let's talk about you. How can I be of service to you? And that has saved me so many times. Because another thing I found out when I got sober is that just because I'm sober doesn't mean everything is rainbows and unicorns. The world does not owe me anything because I decided to show up for life. And so I still get speeding tickets. Much fewer speeding tickets now today. But, I get, my face breaks out and the boyfriend breaks up with me. And, I hit red lights on the way to work and, I get in a bad mood. Life still continues to happen. But today I'm an active participant in that. And I welcome the experience. I think that whenever I was in my addiction, I wanted to numb out. I wanted to change the way I feel. I did not have the tools and the skills that I needed to live life on life's terms, and today I do. When I'm not going to cuss, but when the ish hits the fan, I know what I have to do, and I know what tools to pull out of my toolbox, and. And that's amazing. And October 10th, 2010, I lost my father. And he died very suddenly and unexpectedly, and it was very tragic. And I did not get to say goodbye to him. And, you know, I immediately went numb and became this hero child, because that's who I was in my family system. You know, I was the one that took care of everyone. And so that's what I did for my mother. I showed up and I fed her and I did her laundry and I made all of the arrangements and took care of my family. But I didn't take care of me. And I went through some PTSD as a result of that. And grief is a very, very strange thing. It's very different than any other emotion. And, you know, I share that with you because, well, for a lot of reasons. First of all, obviously, I did not get high during that time. I never thought about getting high during that time. Did you just hear what I said? I'm a drug addict. I can't get out of bed without swallowing a pill. I lost my father. I got my heart broken. I've actually been fired from a job in recovery. All of these things, y'all, I never thought about using. Okay? And I told you before that I was 5 months sober when the obsession was removed. That was after working step 9. In step 9, we make amends. And in the big book, right after it talks about step 9, it talks about the promises. And in the promises, we get a lot of freedom. And that's exactly what happened for me, okay? In my 5th month of recovery, I made amends to most of everyone on my amends list, and something happened. And I went to a concert in Houston with some normie friends, and I did not plan ahead that there would be alcohol there. And everyone around me was drinking, and it occurred to me that I could care less. I did not want to drink. I didn't care that I could smell it on their breath. It was a non-issue. And I mean, I went into the bathroom in the Toyota Center in Houston and got on my knees and thanked God for that. Because again, I don't do that. Sandy Hollier doesn't do that. Sandy Hollier gets drunk. Sandy Hollier gets wasted. You know, that's what I do on my own power. So I knew it was a miracle. And pretty much ever since then, I have been in that position of neutrality. It is really a non-issue. If I wanted to be a bartender, I could be a bartender. I'm not hiding out from alcohol. I have friends that are not in the program. They drink. I hang out with them. I'm okay with it. When I go visit my mother and I smell the smell of pot smoke in her house, it's not a trigger for me. I do not think about using. I do not want to use. It's not an issue for me. And that is a miracle. There is no way to explain it. From the age of like 13 or 14 until 30, I was high. Or finding a way to get high. Or change the way I feel. You know? Austin recovery is different. It took some adjusting here in this city, but I was willing to make the effort, and I have a great group of friends in the program today. I have a lot of support here in the program today. Like I said before, I worked at the treatment center that I was a client at, and I began my LCDC, you know, to pursue my licensure to become a counselor. And I had the opportunity to work at a few other treatment centers, and now I am the director of an outpatient treatment center, and I can't believe it. Thank you. I really can't believe it. I mean, really. And we were just talking about this last night. Like, I can't believe it. And whenever I say that, it makes me realize that it's because I didn't do this. You know, I got connected to a power greater than myself that I call God, and God has brought me to these places, you know. And I show up for work on time. I do the best job I can do every single day. I'm completely dedicated to the company. And, you know, and I just told you earlier that I was stealing from my old employers and lying to them and showing up late and, you know, not showing up at all. And look at the complete 180 that my life has become. But... And I'll tell you what else, too. I shower every single day. My electric bill gets paid on time. In fact, I pay it as soon as it comes in. I have a 2013 model car. It's a new car. You know, I have friends who love me, and I'm a friend to them, and relationship with my family. But I tell you, you know, all of those things just really take a back seat to what really matters most to me, and that's what's going on inside. It's the internal condition. I'm no longer restless, irritable, and discontent. I'm no longer emotionally unstable. I'm free today. And I have peace. And I love me. And I have so much love in my heart for my fellows, my brothers and sisters. And, you know, I couldn't harm someone, you know, if I had a gun pointed to my head. I'm just not even capable of doing that today. And I did awful things to people. You know, that's what keeps me coming back, guys. And that's what keeps me showing up for my recovery, is that peace of mind that I've been given. You know, I recently was called and asked to do a 12-step. Does everyone know what a 12-step is? So a 12-step is when there's someone who's high or drunk and needs help from a sober member of a 12-step group. So I was called. I had to work the next day. I was very busy. I had a lot going on. I did not want to do it. But I knew that I had to. And so I went and got this girl, and I brought her to my house. And a friend of mine came over, and we did this little mini intervention on her. And we got her into treatment that night. And I got home at about 2 o'clock in the morning. And I had to wake up at like 6:30 and go to work and work all day. It was very inconvenient, is the point. And it was emotionally draining, spiritually very rewarding. I was so grateful for the experience after I did it. And I can tell you that that's kind of been a pattern for me. Sponsee calls, oh, I want to answer it. I'm watching TV right now. Or, you know, I have to do a fifth step. When am I going to do that? That lasts like 3 or 4 hours. Someone reaches out, and you know, these are the things that we probably don't want to talk about, but I'm here to tell you my truth, and I want you to feel like you can relate. If I were to stand up here and say, oh my God, I love recovery, I love being of service, I'm all about it, and I, you know, everything's wonderful, and if I presented to you like I work a perfect program, that's not tangible, that's not attainable. Know that I make mistakes, that I have bad days, that I get in fear, that I behave agnostically. And I take it back. I give it to God, and I take it back, you know. And so I don't work a perfect program, but I'm willing to suit up and show up, you know. And let me tell you, too, that whenever I do take back control and I get selfish and self-centered and I get into fear and I'm dishonest, I suffer. Because you know what? Today I am connected to the sunlight of the Spirit. I have a direct channel. In fact, sometimes I feel like I am part of it. It's all one. I'm the sun, the beam is coming straight down over me and through me, and I am the beam. Okay? And so what that means is that I'm very sensitive to my spirit, which means I cannot hurt you. I cannot lie to you. I cannot steal from you. I cannot be dishonest, manipulative. And when I am, I feel it in here. Oops, sorry, I touched the mic. Sorry about that. I can feel it. I'm very connected, very sensitive to it. I do not have the luxury of being that person anymore. I'm no longer numb. I'm awake. And I'll tell you one thing, too, is that I've experienced a lot of people in this program with multiple years of sobriety who are still asleep. They're still numbing out. They might not be using drugs. They might not be drinking, but they're numbing out one way or the other. You know, love is one way, relationships, sex, money, power. A lot of us become workaholics. There are many, many ways, you know, gambling, that we can continue to numb out and remain asleep. And sometimes I get a little jealous of that, you know, because they're just kind of coasting through life, not really feeling anything. And it's a little bit harder when you're awake because you're connected and you can feel things. And I feel my feelings. I feel pain. I feel sadness. I feel extreme joy too, though, you know, and I wouldn't trade it really at the end of the day because I am awake and I am having a human experience. I'm alive. It's priceless. You know, it's weird because I got asked to speak here at Benchmark Recovery Center, and that's a big deal. And I feel like, you know, this is just, I'm just this girl, you know, I'm just this little girl still sometimes who is hurting and, you know, wants to be loved and wants to give love. But the truth is that this really is my life. I've just been given this amazing, beautiful gift of recovery, and recovery is life. You know, it's not, you know, when I'm at the meeting or when I'm sitting across from my sponsor. Recovery is life. Recovery is every aspect of me. Everything I do is my recovery. So, you know, we were just saying, recovery is life, is recovery is life. It's all one and the same. So my journey of recovery is my journey of life. It doesn't ever turn off. I'm incapable. I'm not, you know, the stage character presenting to you who I think you want me to be. It's just me. I'm this person here. I'm this person at home when no one's looking. I'm this person at work. I'm this person with my family. I'm this person with my friends. What you see is what you get. I can be genuine and authentic today. All of the promises came true for me. I don't really know what else to say. I think I'm going to close it up. You guys, thank you so much for this opportunity. And I love you all very much. Thank you.